Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, get ready to do some sit-ups and run a mile. The presidential fitness test is back.
And pining for a time you never actually experienced.
But first, the CHIPS Act was a big win for Arizona when it passed Congress in 2022, a bipartisan effort to pump billions into the domestic semiconductor industry. It was one of President Joe Biden's signature achievements in office. But President Donald Trump has never been a fan, and that may be an understatement. He said the legislation let Taiwan, quote, take our chip business, and that it's a, quote, horrible, horrible thing. And now Arizonans might be finding out that wasn't all talk. KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke with our politics desk is on the line now to tell us more. Hey there, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so for the most part, we have not seen the Trump administration target CHIPS Act funding that's been awarded here in Arizona, and there's been a lot of it. But there are a few examples where we've seen the administration getting involved. And one is, of course, the president kind of strong-arming Intel into ceding 10% of ownership to the federal government, right?
Yeah, this made big news a few weeks ago, essentially the federal government agreeing to give Intel about $9 billion in exchange for 10% or so of its stock. And the reason this was interesting to me, and you used the word strong arm, so did I in my article, is that most of that money came from the CHIPS Act. It was already awarded to Intel, but not yet paid out. So it's essentially Trump putting his stamp on that CHIPS Act funding by saying, hey, I'm going to get something out of Intel for this money.
All right. So what else are we seeing when it comes to the Trump administration and CHIPS Act funding?
So more recently, we saw the Department of Commerce roll back funding to this entity called NatCast, which is a nonprofit that was basically set up after the CHIPS Act to run this national semiconductor technology center, this kind of clearinghouse for cutting edge research and development. And some of that money was supposed to head to Arizona. It was supposed to go to ASU and set up this basically, like I said, cutting edge research and development facility that would allow semiconductor manufacturers to be on the bleeding edge of new technology in that area.
Right. So it would have been called the National Semiconductor Technology Center. This is a big thing, but now we're talking about some changes coming to that from the Trump administration. They're stepping in. How?
Yes, the Department of Commerce sent a letter over to NatCast essentially saying we're taking back control of this NSTC. Like I said, after the CHIPS Act, the NatCast was set up to operate that center. The CHIPS Act actually specifically said within the legislation that there was supposed to be this sort of public-private partnership situation to run the center. But the Department of Commerce under Trump is now alleging that the Biden administration kind of violated the law when it set this thing up and kept it, there's no more oversight from the Trump administration, they're arguing, and that violated the law.
Okay, so they claim this was political, essentially?
Yeah, they're saying that the Biden administration basically filled this nonprofit with political allies, things of that nature. And I think Secretary Lutnick, current Commerce Secretary, called it a slush fund. And it is true that some of the leadership has ties to the Biden administration, though they had said early on that they used an independent selection committee to pick the initial board.
So this investment was a really big deal for ASU. ASU President Michael Crow called it, quote, the greatest national laboratory investment since those that came out of the Manhattan Project. What has the university had to say about this move and the Trump administration clawing this funding back?
Not much so far. Basically, all they've been able to tell me is that they haven't been able to assess the impact of what this decision will have. But yeah, as you said, it was a huge deal. I mean, Senator Mark Kelly, who was part of negotiating the CHIPS Act, told me in a statement that basically these type of senators, there were three of them that NatCast was supposed to oversee, would ensure that the American semiconductor industry would be the one making these technological breakthroughs that are needed, as AI and all these other things are coming through and need that new technology instead of that research being done overseas.
So will this National Semiconductor Technology Center still happen? Do we know?
That is a very good question and one I am trying to get answers to, but so far either people don't know or they're not telling. I've asked the Department of Commerce that question, which should be, you know, the ones to be making that decision. And they have not gotten back to me. I've reached out to a lot of the members of the congressional delegation and haven't really been able to get a firm answer. But I mean, they basically said they're taking off, the Department of Commerce said they're taking operational control of NatCAS. So that could theoretically mean that they're taking control of existing awards that they've sent out, or it could mean that they're starting from scratch. We just really don't know the answer yet.
Mm. So Wayne, will we likely see more impacts of all of this debate about CHIPS Act funding here in Arizona? There had been concerns earlier on that we might see more, you know, funding clawed back. There's been a whole lot of CHIPS Act investment here.
Yeah, like you mentioned earlier, Intel, Taiwan Semiconductor, TSMC has got a bunch of those CHIPS Act grants. So I don't know that we're going to see anything like we're seeing right now with NatCast, where it was straight up being pulled back. But I think the Intel situation is interesting. We could see the Trump administration maybe trying to dip into money that hasn't actually been paid out yet and figuring out how they can put their stamp on it, similar to what they did with Intel.
Yeah. Okay. We will leave it there for now. That is KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, we'll have more on this in the future as this all plays out, I'm sure. Wayne, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
In the midst of the recent headlines about the awful conditions and possible closure at President Trump's so-called alligator Alcatraz, AZ Mirror recently reported on a similar facility right here in the Valley. It's called the Arizona Removal Operations Coordination Center, or AROC, and it's actually been here since 2010, but its existence hasn't been widely reported on until now. With increased scrutiny on the Trump administration's ramped-up dependence on these so-called temporary hold facilities, Jared McDonald Evoy wrote the Mirror's deep dive on AROC, and he joins me now. Jared, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being here. So as part of your reporting on this, you actually went over and took some pictures of this facility. Can you describe it to us?
Yeah, it's a pretty nondescript airport kind of style building over at the Mesa Gateway facility. It's been there since about 2010. It was opened around then. It can house around 157 detainees and around 79 employees from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's housed along as well with the Phoenix Interagency Fire Center, where the United States Forest Service also has facilities as well.
And so this is ostensibly a temporary hold facility. What does that mean?
So temporary hold facilities and staging centers for ICE are areas where they will hold people who are either going to be transferred to another ICE facility for long-term detention, such as, you know, facilities like we know of and are really well aware of in places like Florence and Eloy, mm-hmm. or in other cities, or to be deported. Which is more often the case with this facility, when I looked at detainee transfers and deportation and detention statistics that were released by ICE, a lot of the people that come through this facility are often being taken from this facility to another country, as this area is a hub for that activity.
And as a result of the intention of this temporary hold nature, these places generally are not set up to house people long term, correct?
Correct. In audits I found of this facility from 2017 and 2022, the auditors themselves said that ICE had told them that, you know, this is a temporary hold facility meant to house people for up to 12 hours at most. And so there are no beds, no showers. No, one auditor noted that there was no on-site food or medical staff, and that they would have to rely on the Florence Staging and Processing Center, which is about an hour drive away, for those kind of things if they needed it. There was one shower on the facility, but none of those are in the hold rooms. The holding rooms that they have at this facility do have bathrooms with kind of like a privacy curtain, as it was described in mm-hmm. the audits, but no actual beds or anything like that that you would see at, say, like a county jail.
But in spite of that, as you found, there were a number of instances where people were stuck there for a pretty long time.
Yeah, I found in the data about 95 incidents where people were staying for longer than 48 hours. Recently in June, there were about 77 people who stayed for about a 4-day weekend. And were then later, I was able to kind of identify the flight that those people took. They were chartered on through a company called Omni Air, where they were taken and deported later to countries like Bangladesh, Pakistan, and some other places, which those are pretty lengthy charter flights. So they stayed for 4 days in this facility with no food or water. They might have had food, we're not sure, because a lot of the problems with this these types of facilities, as I've learned from speaking with other attorneys and advocates in this space, the immigration space, is there's not a lot of information that comes out of these facilities.
Right, right. And I mean, I think in one case you said somebody was stuck there for 42 days. There was a Muslim detainee who was stuck there over the weekend of a religious holiday, correct?
Correct. That he was one of the 77 who was there over that 4-day period. He was there during Eid al-Adha, and he was deported to Bangladesh, I believe, according to the data that I reviewed.
So speaking of the places that these folks are being sent, this story is part of a larger story that you've been reporting for years at this point, which is this idea of, quote, ICE Air. Remind us what you mean when you use that phrase.
So ICE Air is kind of a colloquial term that refers to the operations, which are actually headquartered at the Mesa Gateway Airport, that Immigration and Customs Enforcement does in regards to transferring the detainees they have throughout the country and to be deported. It refers to the fleet of aircraft, whether they're charter or owned by ICE itself. Most of the ICE Air fleet or operations are chartered through things like the main charter company they use currently is CSI Aviation, which then uses other companies they charter out to, like Avelo, Omni, and others, to conduct these deportation flights, which they also call repatriation flights. We used to do these more internally. We had a system called JPATS, Justin Prisoner and Alien Transportation System. But then we've over the years transferred that more to completely kind of like a contractor subcontractor system. Although ICE has been in recent months looking to possibly kind of take that back over and buy their own fleet of aircraft and start doing this on their own again with the speed that the Trump administration and the kind of tone that they're trying to set with the amount of deportations they're trying to do.
Right. Now, in your piece, Jared, you have some pretty harrowing details about what it's like for the detainees to be on those flights. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, from what we know about from these flights that we've heard from flight attendants who have been on these flights, from detainees that have been on these flights, and from internal ICE documents that have been released, people who are put on these flights, they're shackled at their feet and hands, and put on these flights that are often very long flights. You're talking about transatlantic, going across the Pacific type flights. There was one class action lawsuit against the United States where a group of these detainees were sitting on the tarmac in Louisiana for about 23 hours, were denied access to the restrooms, ended up soiling themselves. There's been other instances where there's been deaths on these flights and miscarriages, and other instances where, you know, detainees have been put in these body bag style restraints in order to kind of keep them from acting up or having issues. And then there's also been reports of issues with the subcontractors, because not all the people who work security on these flights are ICE themselves. Sometimes they're subcontractors with groups like Geo Group or other security firms, where there's kind of less oversight you might see when it's a government entity. And so there's been some critiques from immigration attorneys and immigrant rights groups about how that's kind of happened on these flights.
Yeah, I can imagine. All right. Well, lots of harrowing details there. Jared, thank you for your reporting. That is Jared McDonald Evoy, who reported on AROC for AZ Mirror.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the tiny yet expansive world of miniature sculpture. We'll hear from an artist on her process of molding nostalgic mini vignettes.
But first, President Trump announced recently he's bringing back the presidential fitness test. You might remember it from when you were in school and as a kid. I know I do. It involved, you know, running a mile, doing sit-ups, pull-ups, a shuttle run. Launched in public schools in the 1950s, it was championed by President John F. Kennedy in the 60s, following the publication of his famous article, The Soft American.
I welcome this opportunity to speak to the people of America about a subject which I believe to be most important, and that is the subject of physical fitness. And I speak not only as president of the United States, but also as a parent of two children who I hope will grow up with those qualities of vigor and energy which we identify with the best of America. This should be a matter of concern to us all. A country is as strong, really, as its citizens. And I think that mental and physical health, mental and physical vigor, go hand in hand.
We don't know yet what this new era of the presidential fitness test will look like, but our next guest says in the age of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again or BAHA movement, it's certain to be interesting. Brianne Fawes is an author and professor of women and gender studies and social and cultural analysis at Arizona State University. Her most recent book is called Fat and Furious. I spoke with her more about this new move by the Trump administration.
Well, I mean, I think what we end up with the Trump administration constantly is a kind of reversal of logic, right? So if we recall when Michelle Obama was doing her initiatives many years ago to try to get children to eat more vegetables and to eat slightly more healthy, it was met by many conservatives with absolute ire, right? And so I think what's interesting is, you know, under the guise of, oh, this is about health, we end up kind of moving in these strange directions with the Trump administration. And that seems to be happening again with this.
Okay, so let's talk about the presidential fitness test itself. We're not quite sure what this new iteration might look like, but you remember taking this in school? I remember it. It was like a mile run, sit-ups, push-ups,
sure,
shuttle
yes.
run, stuff like that. Did you take this in school?
I did, yeah.
What are your memories of it?
I mean, I was a pretty intense athlete at the time, and I still remember it was kind of awful, you know, because I don't think anyone really responds all that well to metrics and litmus tests of exactly what the body is supposed to do. And again, what's interesting, right, is even people who are, you know, in excellent physical shape often struggle with certain tasks on that test. And so, and again, that's sort of here nor there, right? I mean, I don't think this is like the hill I'm going to die on and that anyone else is going to die on is the presidential fitness test. But I think it really is an interesting question to sort of wonder why now, why is this the thing that's coming up again? How does this sort of fit into the MAHA agenda, right? So the thing itself seems sort of like a non-issue compared to what it sort of symbolizes or represents.
That's interesting. So proponents, right, of this will argue that, you know, we have a childhood obesity epidemic in the country, that we need to reverse that, that we need to protect kids' health, we need them to exercise more, all of those things. Do you see that as fitting into that broader narrative you're talking about with MAHA?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, right? Like I'm saying, you know, if we look back in time a little bit, you see there's so much backlash against any efforts that were made to sort of, you know, think more holistically about food deserts, to think about broadening access to food stamps, things, you know, like things that people need in order to have access to healthy foods and produce, you know, thinking about reducing the amount of hours that people work so they have time for leisure, that they sleep better, that they exercise. Mm. Wellness is a big thing, right? And so the MAHA version of this, I think, is quite particular and peculiar and leaves out a lot of these like broader kind of views, right? Including views of, you know, the majority of medical doctors in the country and things like that. But yeah, if we're thinking about this question, and I think we should think about this, of what does health mean and what does it look like? It looks like a lot of things, right? And so when we're thinking about what makes healthy kids, yes, of course, exercise is excellent. So is access to going outside. So is having leisure time, having time to play, having cognitively stimulating activities, solid friendships, right? Like, so I'm also a therapist, which I should mention.
Yeah.
So I also think a lot about these broader stories about the kinds of things that seem to be under attack right now and going away, and the kinds of things that are in ascendancy, especially in terms of, the kinds of things people are talking about a lot. And we leave out so many of those things, right? If we're thinking about what makes a healthy kid, we need a lot of attention to things about, again, what are they eating? How are they exercising? Do they have access to that? How do they learn social skills? Do they have time to play? Are they having kind of a synergy between parent involvement and the schools? I mean, we could go on and on, right? But so many of these aspects get kind of, just shrunk down into one tiny pinpoint, which is, I think, a big problem with this particular topic as well.
So your most recent book is about anti-fatness, fat shaming. There is a tension, though, as you're kind of getting at there, that it kind of can be in opposition to the medical establishment saying that being fat does not mean that you're not healthy. Do you think that bringing back something like the presidential fitness test kind of conflates those things again?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's not so much that we want to sort of ask the question of, is fatness healthy or not, as much as we want to sort of think about why is fatness cast in certain ways and why is there so much emotion attached to fatness in such a negative way, right? So, I mean, we find things that people, you're not really even allowed to self-identify as fat because people think it's a derogatory sort of self-shaming term, which it absolutely is not. So, I mean, we are so far away from even imagining that someone has the right to just exist or self-label as fat, let alone how we kind of fold that into stories about health, right? And stories about health often are laced with very intense stories that have moral content, right? So that thinness and morality get sort of linked together, and fatness and immorality get linked together. I mean, so many fat activists, I would say in some ways myself included, are constantly trying to sort of trouble this binary and sort of think, well, it's not so much that the argument is fat is healthy. It's that we want to divorce the idea that fatness is linked with all kinds of negative, emotionally negative evaluative judgments. And certainly kind of, we want to do the same with thinness, right? Otherwise, we don't really make any progress in terms of social justice, and we don't make space for bodies to sort of do what they do, which is be disobedient, gain and lose weight, get older, right? There's so many stories that fit into this that go way beyond the story of fatness. And the book is really also trying to argue that as well, right? That we need to think about fatness, even if we don't think it's an issue that directly applies to our lives, because it is an issue of bodies and justice, and it attaches to so many other things that will be an issue for us, like I said, aging, or the body sort of, getting sick, the body changing, all the things that bodies do that are not necessarily things that we choose for them to do.
That's so interesting. So you're talking about this idea of fat activism, right? And the basic divorcing of that binary that you're trying to do in that realm. Do you think we're getting further and further away from that? Whereas maybe a couple of years ago, it felt like we were starting to have that conversation in a real way?
I mean, I think it's up and down, right? I mean, I don't know if there's much that's progressing in the Trump administration years right now. I mean, we're kind of back to an era where everyone seems to be on the defensive. So it will be interesting to sort of think in reframed ways about how can we not always, especially as progressives, simply be reacting to the kind of endless barrage of traumas and chaos that's happening. So I do feel like that sets everything up to have a very weird tenor right now. But I do think there's certainly from Gen Z, we're seeing a lot more interest in thinking about bodies in critical ways. I mean, it's not ideal, but the embrace of body positivity is on the rise. I think people are recognizing what happens when we just take anti-fatness as a taken for granted assumption and how bad that is. And so, what we need, I think, is to boost up the language of thinking in more complex ways about bodies and thinking about body size on a regular basis, so that we can sort of have these conversations in like more with more clarity, with more energy, and I think the more that we do that, the more that these stories start to fall apart, and that's really helpful and good.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there. Brienne Fawes is an author and professor of women and gender studies at and social and cultural analysis at Arizona State University joining us. Brienne, thank you for coming back on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. The stellar system closest to our sun appears to be the home of a planet. It's in the Alpha Centauri system, just 4 light years away from us. And if the planet turns out to be real, it'd mean there's a planet in what's known as the habitable zone of the closest star. And that could have implications for the possibility of life. Kevin Wagner first got a hint of this planet a few years ago, but new observations from the James Webb Space Telescope have him even more excited. Wagner is an assistant research professor at the University of Arizona, where he says, in its simplest terms, he takes pictures of planets around nearby stars. Our co-host Mark Brody spoke with him about this and asked what exactly we're talking about with this latest news.
So we're talking about the deepest images of the closest sun-like star. And by deep, I mean we're looking at a very bright star, and any planets around it are going to be fainter points of light. So the depth of the observation is the faintness of the point of light that we're able to see next to it. So we're pushing down towards not quite Earth-like planets, but definitely into the regime of giant planets. So if there's a Jupiter-like planet in an Earth-like orbit, that's what we're able to see, is a faint point of light right next to this very bright star. And the difference in brightness there is something like 1 to 1,000,000.
And where exactly is this relative to where we are here on Earth?
So Alpha Centauri is the closest stellar system to us. It's a system of 3 stars, Alpha Centauri A and B, and then they're orbited by a red dwarf star called Proxima.
And why is this so potentially interesting to you?
Well, it's interesting for a number of reasons. One, being the closest stellar system to us, any planets around it, once we have identified them, are ones that we'll be able to study in the most amount of detail. Also, being the closest star, we can think about sending robotic probes there in the not too distant future and to get really exquisite data on these systems. Beyond that, I think this is the most logical stepping stone for humanity as we progress out into the galaxy. It's a factor of 3 closer than the next closest sun-like star. So it's just the logical place to go. And if it has a habitable planet or a habitable moon around a giant planet, then that makes it all the more exciting.
Let me ask you about the habitability, because it seems as though we have no idea really what's there now, but it seems as though the conditions are right for potentially life to exist there. Whether or not it does, like I said, we don't know. How significant is it that this is in sort of what scientists call the habitable zone, where life could theoretically exist?
So I'd say it's quite significant and very exciting. We're still just talking about a candidate planet, so the planet itself needs to be confirmed, and then we can go and look for rocky moons that might be orbiting it, and that would be the exciting environment for which we would look for life in.
Why would that be the exciting part?
Well, life as we know it needs a surface. We could possibly imagine, and people like Carl Sagan have imagined in the past, there being sort of atmospheric life beings in the atmosphere of a giant planet. But if we're talking about looking for life like we know it on Earth, then we're talking about life on the surface of a rocky planet or a rocky moon, and likely a rocky body that has liquid water on its surface.
And am I right that the planet that you are looking at now, the assumption is that it is a gas planet, not a rocky surface planet?
Right. So we get that measurement from the brightness. What we measure is really just brightness in the image, and then we compare that to planetary brightness models, and these largely depend on the planet's radius and its temperature. The temperature we have a fairly good understanding of from the separation of the planet candidate from the star. So with the temperature essentially set, then we're left with a measurement of radius, and that places it at about the radius of Jupiter.
How important has the James Webb Space Telescope been to getting to this information?
Well, it's very important. It's the only telescope that exists that can do this right now. The planet candidate was initially seen from the ground, but it was a really sort of one-off experiment that took over one of the biggest telescopes on Earth for a whole month and just stared at the brightest star in the sky for as much clear observing time as we could get for a month. That hasn't been done again and probably won't be done at that scale again in the future, since, well, there's only really one closest star that you can do it for. But Webb is opening up additional views of that closest star in less time than, well, it doesn't take a month to get the same sort of detection with web. We can do it just in a bit over a day.
Hmm.
And then it also opens up other stars.
So how then do you plan to go about continuing to study and research this?
So for this planet candidate, the next steps is to, the obvious next step is to get another observation with Webb. So we have the one detection from the ground, and we have the one detection with Webb. And then we also have two non-detections with Webb, which basically just tell us that if this is a planet, then there's only so much space in the image where we wouldn't have seen it. And that's basically when it's too close to the star. So from these two detections and two non-detections, we can place constraints on the planet's orbit. And from those orbital constraints, we can predict where it will be again in the future. And then if we point Webb at Alpha Centauri again about a year from now, then we have a very strong prediction for where the planet should be and that we should be able to see it. And then if we see it in that spot, then that would be rock solid confirmation. And then we can think about things like studying its spectra for possible signs of atmospheric life or looking for exomoons around it and all sorts of other interesting possibilities.
Well, yeah. So like, is it a possibility to potentially send something to get closer and really get more detailed looks and maybe even measurements of particular aspects of this planet candidate at some point?
That's an aspect of this that is unique to Alpha Centauri, that we can actually envision going there. And by going there, I mean, at first, tiny robotic spacecraft, things that are on the scale of grams that have likely the means of propulsion that are going to get these crafts there would be lasers. They could get to a fraction of the speed of light. And then being only 4 light years away, if you're traveling at the fraction of the speed of light, this is something that we can envision happening within just a matter of decades.
So you have been quoted as calling this one of the most exciting results in astronomy of the decade. And I'm curious, what leads you to say that?
Well, I don't think it's quite there yet, but I think it's shaping up to be. If this planet were confirmed as an actual planet in the habitable zone of the closest star, then I think it would qualify as one of the most exciting results of the decade. And in particular, because it would almost certainly have moons. Almost every planet in the solar system has moons. Jupiter has multiple moons, many of them, if they weren't orbiting Jupiter, but were orbiting the sun, we would call them planets in their own right. So I think it would be more surprising if a giant planet doesn't have moons than if it did. So if this planet is real, then I think it very likely has moons, and those moons would also be in the habitable zone. And that just opens up so many possibilities for astrobiology, for even the possible future of human civilization.
All right. That is Kevin Wagner, an assistant research professor at the University of Arizona. Kevin, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. It's been great talking to you.
If you're the kind of person who believes that less is more, it might be because you've never experienced the work of fashion designer Anna Sui. Tempe writer Audrey Trion explains.
The other day, I put on a polka dot headscarf, a white blouse, a DIY ribbon choker, 80s-era dome earrings, 4 watches, 8 rings, an espresso-toned satchel, beat-up Wrangler jeans, leather pumps, and I went to Trader Joe's. Other customers were dressed in tank tops and leggings, but I wasn't dressing for them. It makes me happy. I love fashion. I spend my downtime browsing The RealReal, and the second edition of a book called Fashion Theory is my Bible. It's a world where every day I wake up and have the pleasure of opening my closet to choose my own adventure. Earlier this summer, I stepped into the world of Anna Sui, the latest fashion-oriented exhibit from Phoenix Art Museum. It felt like meeting a kindred spirit. Sui is known for her funky character, affinity for rock and roll, and the ability to channel joy from a piece of fabric, or a mannequin. Like the blue mannequin I spied wearing a psychedelic, disco-esque jumpsuit, a patterned Penny Lane coat, a crocheted Viking helmet with blonde braids peeking out, and a red-lipped smirk. As far as I'm concerned, fashion should be fun, whimsical, and campy. Clearly, Anna Sui feels the same. The show features over 80 ensembles from Sui's vast archive, including jeweled medallions, gingham paperboy caps, zebra print mini dresses, velvet Victorian era inspired garments, and a reiteration of the Shining Twins' baby doll dresses, all adorning pastel mannequins. Often seen sporting blunt bangs, a black cat eye, and her signature rouge lip, Sui has crafted her iconic persona as much as she crafts her designs. She uses her surroundings, the music she listens to, her friends and family, the vintage she collects, the movies she sees, as a source of inspiration. A first-generation American, Sui grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan, and later moved to New York City to attend Parsons School of Design. She spent her adolescence infatuated with the punk scene of the 60s and 70s. Sui's development as a designer was invigorated by DIY shows in garages and backyards and playing seamstress for her dolls. From there, she built her iconic brand, making Anna Sui a namesake designer. The day after visiting the exhibit, I put on a Canadian tuxedo, moth bolo tie, leather jacket with 2-inch shoulder pads, cheetah print scarf, and green boots. To be honest, that's probably what I would have worn to the bookstore anyhow, but I felt a stronger sense of self-possession, self-confidence, and unapologetic expression wearing it. I can't help but think Anna Sui had something to do with that.
That was Audrey Trion, author of the Substack, Confessions of a Fashion Fanatic. You can see the world of Anna Sui at Phoenix Art Museum through September 28th. And you're listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Picture it. A vintage desktop computer, complete with a chunky monitor and a mouse connected to a cable, sitting on an old wooden desk. A cat relaxes on the desk chair. In an open drawer, letters in sealed envelopes are ready to be sent. A fish floats in a tank on a nearby shelf of books. It's a familiar, somewhat nostalgic scene, but the whole thing is A, made out of clay, and B, built on a tiny dollhouse-size scale. The artist is Phoenix sculptor Paige Hammond, who spends up to 40 hours crafting these tiny scenes, many of which depict worlds from the not-so-distant past. She posts videos of her creation on Instagram and TikTok, where her hundreds of thousands of fans leave comments saying the pieces, quote, just do something to them, and they marvel at the accuracy and specificity. I spoke with Hammond last week to get a deeper understanding of the tender emotions that underpin her sculptures, which Hammond describes as miniatures.
It's kind of just anything that's not its usual scale. Mm-hmm. Most people have like 1/12 scale or 1/6 scale or a certain scale that they like, but I don't really like to measure. I just like to kind of do my own little thing, and it pretty much is just anything smaller than the usual item, I would say.
And you do these in a couple different formats, right? You have made like little recreations of like the Scholastic Book Fair mm-hmm. in miniature. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's like a little scene. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you also just make a very small like vintage iPod.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about the final form of it when you start making it? Do you like see the final version of it in your mind ahead of time, or do you just kind of start sculpting and see where it goes?
I feel like it depends on the project, but I definitely, like the way my brain is, I just see it and then I kind of like I'm able to make it happen. I'm not actually a good drawer at all. So like 2D is not my thing at all, but for some reason 3D, I've always like been able to close my eyes and just kind of visualize it, especially with like the nostalgic stuff that I've done. It's very like reminiscent and I can just picture it in my head.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because there is such a strong note of nostalgia in your work. I mean, the Scholastic Book Fair, there's an Etch-a-Sketch. When did you start seeing these vintagey items in your mind?
It's kind of hard to explain, but I always joke around with my family because they're like, Paige, you remember everything. And I really do. Like, I just have a really good, almost like photographic memory of like my childhood and stuff like that. It's very much like I'll look at pictures and stuff like that, but there's touches in there that are genuinely just like how I remember them. And I feel like that makes it feel more real.
The fact that it's filtered through your memory.
It's like a lived experience, but made to be small.
Yeah. Well, is there a feeling that goes along with picturing something like the Scholastic Book Fair that you're trying to channel?
For sure. I think like so many people, when they get to a certain age, you get really nostalgic about your childhood. And there's almost kind of like a sadness to it, but I've gotten comments before of people being like, would you ever put like, you know, statues or figures or people inside of the rooms? And I don't think I ever would, because that's kind of like symbolic to me that there's, it's still there, but there's nothing in there, if that makes sense. It's like the memory's been left behind.
You mentioned being nostalgic for childhood. Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
Yeah, I'm 23.
You're 23. Do you feel nostalgic for childhood?
For sure, for sure. I was the kind of kid who would cry and break down at like six because I wasn't a baby anymore. Like, I've always just had like, I guess like anxiety and stuff like that about just like getting older. And I think it's funny now because, you know, I'm a grown adult and I basically play with toys for a living and I get to like just be creative. But yeah, I think it's interesting how everyone has a different perception of childhood. And, you know, sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad, but there is like almost a homesickness for that time for me.
What do you associate with that time?
I think I just associate like, you know, school, elementary school. I associate like life pre-technology, I think is a big one for me. I definitely get homesick for a time that I didn't live in because we're so inundated with our phones and stuff these days.
So you were born in what, 2002?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you didn't really know a time before a lot of this stuff.
And I kind of wish that I didn't grow up with that. Obviously, that's kind of silly to say, considering, you know, I do social media and stuff like that. But I think a lot of people my age would agree that, you know, maybe the phones did a little too much, you know?
What do you imagine that time was like?
I think it was just a lot more, people were a lot more present. It was, there was more human connection. I guess, yeah, just people being in the present moment. And maybe I romanticized that time because I didn't live in it, but.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, as somebody who was alive at that time, mm-hmm. I haven't thought about this before this conversation, but I guess I could look back and say like, yeah, maybe you were more present, but I also was too young to appreciate the importance of being present. If that makes sense.
That makes total sense.
So yeah. Maybe it's like, I didn't know how good I had it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is good about the idea of being present?
I just think we're so connected these days. You really can't be alone, but somehow there's still kind of a lack of like human connection in real life. Like personally, you know, I do my work at home and I graduated high school COVID year. And so I went into college during that whole time of just switching to online school and stuff. And somehow you can be connected to so many people and still feel very alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, ironically, as you were pointing out, you are very active on social media. You have yes. hundreds of thousands of followers on TikTok and Instagram.
Mm.
I also understand that, you know, as a working artist, you have to find a way to get your work out there. Mm. And those are the tools that we use to do that. What do you hear from people who interact with the videos that you post?
It's always cool to see other people around my age, you know, connect with especially the nostalgia stuff and being like, that looks just like my room, or that looks exactly like my elementary school's PE closet. It is cool, though, just to see that what I'm making can make people feel a certain way. I think that's the coolest thing.
And that way is you feel like they're kind of tapping into that longing you're feeling?
Yeah, yeah. And they feel that nostalgia and maybe the happiness and the sadness of it, you know, all the emotions. I just want people to like feel something from it, you know?
Right. Do you show the miniatures anywhere publicly?
I actually don't. As of now, they kind of just sit in my room, which I hope someday that I can maybe put them on display somewhere or do something cool with them.
So that's so interesting to me that there's a way that you're interacting with them,
mm-hmm.
which is so tactile and so specific.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the way that your fans interact with them where there's this divide.
Yeah. It's interesting how, you know, on social media and stuff, I can manipulate it to look a certain way. Like I can zoom it in and zoom it out.
Can I ask you, it also strikes me that there's a big difference craft-wise
mm-hmm.
in making the miniatures themselves and then thinking about the aesthetic of your videos.
Mm-hmm.
Because another thing I think is interesting about the videos is for the most part, you're not in them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of like kind of heavy shadows framing the objects.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with that aesthetic?
It's so hard to explain, but I think especially with the lighting, my goal is to try and dramatize it as much as I can. Mm-hmm. I actually like the lighting that goes inside of those rooms. I kind of figured out a way to, once I flip off all those lights and it's just the light that's on inside of the miniature, it does look like nothing else exists around it, which is really cool. It's a cool effect.
Well, Paige Hammond is an artist working in miniatures. And what is your TikTok handle?
It's Paige with a baby face. I have a baby face. It's true.
And is on TikTok at Paige with a baby face. Paige, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be so cool, Sam, to see just our little studio host right here in miniature.
It makes me nostalgic for today's show already.
Exactly. Already nostalgic. All right. Well, if you have ever wanted to see us do the show, by the way, we are putting it on stage. It's going to be fun. It's September 14th coming up here at Crescent Ballrooms. Mark your calendars and go to rsvp.kjzz.org for more info.
Yes, that's right. What's that phrase Kevin Wagner used? Pretty significant and very exciting. I don't know if the show is as significant as A New Planet, but it's pretty close.
Pretty good.
Pretty close. Speaking of shows, we're going to have another one tomorrow morning at 9, so make sure you join us then. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. Thanks for listening.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.